Okay, we have two new panelists. Let me introduce them. We have Carrie Russell from the American Library Association, Association of College and Research Libraries, and Association of Research Libraries. And we have Fritz Attaway from the Motion Picture Association of America. And we have lost Rashmi Rangmath from Public Knowledge. And anybody else? That's it. Okay. Great. So we lost one and gained two. And this is the second panel, and we're very interested in market initiatives, exciting things that are happening in the nonprofit and the commercial worlds. And we have two demonstrations. I guess I'd like to ask if you could raise your hand if you would like to make an opening statement in connection with this panel, especially asking the folks who have already made an opening statement this morning. Could you raise your hand if you'd like to do that? Certainly, Carrie, George. Okay, Carrie, George, Gary. Yeah, Fritz, obviously. Brad. Okay, let's do this. Let's start with Carrie, George, and Gary, and then we'll have Fritz do his demonstration, followed by Pearson Publishing. So, Carrie, 5 minutes.
I'll be brief because I know we have the demos and everything. I just want to, the Library Associations want to thank the Copyright Office and the Patent Office for conducting this study. We think it's very important and a good sign that our agencies want to be prepared when they go in to talk about any expansions of these laws at the national or international level, and we really appreciate it. The way we approach this, because there was not that much time to kind of find out what the realm of possibilities were out there, was that we just did a really quick and dirty interview kind of process with as many people as we could. Librarians who work for specialized agencies, librarians who work in public libraries, academic libraries, and then also with reading impaired people, people that did not have accessible formats. And so going through this process, because there was not enough time, it really pointed out to me that we need to really talk more with the users of these products and these formats, because there's so much that we do not know. If for new formats, I think it's just amazing the changing demographic of people out there that might be using these products. And if we had the time, I would just love it if we had the time to do a study of all the people out there that are affected by this. That was my big learning. The librarians overall that I've talked to are grateful, very grateful that they can turn to the Chafee Amendment, the IDEA Act, and fair use when meeting the needs of the visually impaired. They expressed a great concern that please don't take the Chafee Amendment away from us. When told that the Copyright Office was going to study this issue, they just thought they'd come so far with the Chafee Amendment, even though it was a problem. Just please don't take it away. I have a few comments that were in my recommendations. First of all, the eligibility requirements and allowed formats in the Chafee Amendment, the IDEA Act, and the No Child Left Behind Act should be harmonized. There's a lot of confusion. How far the Copyright Office or the Patent Office can go to fixing that problem, I don't know, but there's a great deal of confusion about what's allowed and what's not allowed, and these laws are in conflict. Eligibility requirements necessary to obtain accessible formats need to be relaxed to recognize the growing demographic of people losing their sight in later years. There's a huge, huge population of older people that are losing sight. Even large print formats, which are sometimes allowed and sometimes not allowed, would go a long way in helping these people. Contract law, we believe, should not be permitted to expand the exclusive rights of copyright holders in a matter that denies information access to the visually impaired. We think that the whole Kindle activity highlights kind of an extreme approach to deny the visually impaired same time, same access, same book, same price. Certainly these are individuals that want to buy, that are buying the book, so that they should certainly be able to use it. And we'd like to also recommend that in your report from these proceedings, that the Copyright Office reiterate the fact that fair use, the rights of fair use are not affected by the Chafee Amendment, that people, specialized libraries, aren't the only ones that can make specialized formats, depending on the situation at hand and the four factors, librarians at any institution should be able to make an accessible format at the request of the user. And that's all I'll say for right now.
Thank you, Carrie. George.
Okay, so so I think we've already getting to the point where the copyright exceptions and trusted intermediaries working together can be two concepts living harmoniously. The W3C is the standard-setting body for the Internet, and what the approach that they've taken is with three sets of guidelines for accessibility. One is regarding the content, the web content accessibility guidelines on what constitutes the actual information. The authoring tool guidelines, which is for manufacturers, tech companies, that help people make their products accessible right out of the box. So Adobe InDesign is widely used in the publishing industry. It's not the only thing that's used. But working with Adobe's just joined the DAISY Consortium, and we're very pleased to see that and want to work with them. They do have a Save as DAISY XML in their latest release. It's pretty primitive. We need to work with them, but that should help us. So all of the authoring tools need to be producing accessible content and to make it easy on the publishers. And then finally, the user agent accessibility guidelines, so that the reading systems that are out there, like the Kindle, wouldn't come out with controls that weren't accessible. Digital editions from Adobe is not accessible, and that's a software application that should be accessible. All of these reading systems should be, the guidelines on how to create user agents should be there. So those are some techniques that other industries have done and I think can be applied in the publishing field.
Thank you. Brad, we'll go in order here.
Okay, sure. I'll make this very quick. I just wanted to highlight, I think most if not all of you are familiar with RFBND and what we do. I think actually Lauren, the individual who did not give a last name apparently but submitted comments to this request, put it best. She said, being able to listen to audiobooks, RFBND recordings, etc., was a lifesaver when I was a student from 7th grade to a senior in college. The ability to listen to textbooks, novels for classes helped tremendously in my success at school. We have a long history of meeting the needs of the print-disabled community and are very much dedicated to continuing that. We are focused on educational content. Our online library has 50,000 digitally recorded books, 65% of which are core textbooks for the education community, which is the bulk of the work that we do. The bulk of our materials are human recorded digital audio files in DAISY format, providing key navigation tools by unit, chapter, and page levels. We deliver those files through multiple platforms, CD, and increasingly downloadable through our web-based platforms. We have traditionally not done as much work with electronic text, but that is changing as technology and the marketplace is evolving, and we're very excited about moving more forcefully into that market. Also, collaboration has long been an important part of our work with APH and NLS and our collaboration and between certification efforts and our libraries, and I think I'll leave it at that and let us move on.
And Gary.
I excuse me, I won't reiterate all of what I said earlier, but we some of the collaborative efforts that Brad mentioned earlier that we are engaged in, the LUI database of accessible materials, we have, which is a federally supported national database of more than 196,000 books in accessible format. Now that means Braille, audio, large print, for use by blind and print disabled. LUI is a type of union list, as it provides catalog information of materials with over 170 agencies. LUI has it's a twofold purpose. One is to make the books easier for those who need them to find them, and the other is to reduce and try to eliminate duplication of effort. If a student in California needs a book and a transcriber is beginning to transcribe that book, they usually will put an intention on so that some other transcriber in another state won't start the book. So we try to help with that. NIMAS, APH has developed and managed the National Instructional Materials Access Center, NIMAS, with the which Congress designated in IDEA 2004. NIMAS houses more than 16,000 electronic files of textbooks and related print core materials in a specialized file format. These files are used to produce accessible formats for students at the elementary and secondary school levels. We also have a database of tactile graphics, so that commonly used tactile graphics in textbooks can be downloaded by transcribers from wherever to use that basic tactile graphic to build on for the books they are transcribing. And we have images, commonly used images, that that are available to those transcribers, so that the resources can benefit the most people and the students the best way we possibly can. So that's kind of it.
Thank you very much. Fritz, you should feel free to give an opening statement and then move into your demonstration.
Actually, I'd like to do it in reverse order.
Oh, okay.
Most of what I've heard so far today has related to the print media, and I'm going to change the focus a little bit for a few minutes and talk about movies and other audiovisual works, which are made available to the blind by way of audio description. And I'd just like to show you a short clip of the Bee Movie, which has been audio described by Paramount Pictures, just so everyone knows what I'm talking about. So roll it, please.
Number one, absolutely no talking to humans. All right, launch position!
Around Barry, the jocks jog into arrow-shaped formations, then lower their visors.
Black and yellow!
A jock peers at Barry as the bees crouch.
You ready for this, Hotshot?
Yeah. Yeah, bring it on.
Wind. Check.
Antenna. Check.
Nectar pack. Check. Wing. Check.
Stinger. Check.
Scared out of my shorts. Check.
Okay, ladies. Let's move it out!
Smaller worker bees push the jocks' wings, which whir to life. Smiling Barry crouches with the rest of the jocks as they face a large arched opening.
Hail the petunias, you striped stem suckers! All of you, bring the flowers!
Blue the commander salutes as the pollen jocks streak toward the exit. Much smaller than the others, Barry flies in the middle of one of the outgoing formations. His squadron zips out of the hive, then turns upward and flies through a maze of tree branches. Barry shields his eyes with one hand as they burst into brilliant sunlight.
Whoa! I'm out! I can't believe I'm out!
Skyscrapers tower on the horizon.
So blue!
Barry holds out his arms like airplane wings.
Whoa!
Barry and the jocks skim past huge kites.
feels fast and free. Box kite. Wow.
The bees dive toward a park. They zip past people pedaling bikes along a path. Barry smiles as they fly under an arched stone bridge.
I think you get the idea. I wanted to show this because I think it illustrates a number of points. First of all, obviously, video description or audio description is a way of providing access to movies and other audiovisual works to the blind. It is something that can be done and is being done. I'm advised that most major releases are audio described for the blind. Secondly, I think it illustrates that audio description is complex, it's time consuming, and it requires considerable skill to do. And it is therefore expensive, so there's a cost factor involved. Thirdly, it's a process that requires considerable creative judgment. It's clearly speech that's protected by the First Amendment, and it cannot be compelled by government. And for that proposition, I would cite Pacific Gas and Electric Company versus California Public Utilities. Under our First Amendment, speech cannot be compelled. So that's a consideration. Finally, I think this clip illustrates that there are many creative, technological, financial, and other challenges involved in providing access to audiovisual works to the blind. Copyright is not among these challenges, or if it is, it's relatively insignificant. And I will save further remarks on proposals for copyright exceptions and limitations for the next panel, but I'll just stop there today.
Go to the second demonstration, and Peter, again, if you'd like to do a 5-minute statement as well, you're welcome to do that.
I'm still Peter Chapman. I'm still working for Pearson. I'd like to, in a minute, take the opportunity to very briefly demonstrate to the Copyright Office and other attendees of the panel a new technology which Pearson has developed, which we call HTML Book. It is an HTML-based ebook viewer which is designed to allow assistive technology to easily read the book to a student who cannot utilize either Pearson's other ebook viewers or those from our competitors. Couple points. It's worth reminding the attendees today, which probably is obvious, and that is through many years of providing digital solutions, industry has learned a lot about presenting content from our customers who do not have disabilities. For example, despite its original design for the hearing impaired, captions on television are used by a far greater audience than the visually impaired, which ranges from English language learners to people in noisy environments. I can speak from personal knowledge of this. My wife, having been born outside the country, learned her English watching soap operas and reading them, of course, with the closed caption. My point is this. Many consumers wouldn't have benefited if the government industry had mandated a unique and separate system to deliver TV specifically for the hearing impaired. Pearson believes that solutions that work well for those with disabilities are, in many cases, not all clearly, also going to benefit those that don't. This morning's conversation about the Kindle, I think, was a very good example of that. Students with disabilities, however, provided the impetus for creating the new HTML book technology I'll show you in just a second. However, we at Pearson really aren't clever enough to know absolutely all the ways students are going to use the Pearson HTML book, and we will learn along with the industry. This HTML book is a complete digital version of the textbook. Our internal development team worked very hard to make this product compatible with third-party assistive technology. It contains all the textbook content and nothing else that hinders working with other vendors who want to utilize it. Unfortunately, I don't have any assistive technology with it, so for those who are visually impaired today, you won't be able to hear it. Pearson itself doesn't make those technologies, but we have built this to work with those technologies. So, why don't you flip the switch? There you go. Obligatory picture of my kids. Okay. So what I've done is just launched a standard browser. This happens to be Firefox. I happen to be running on a Macintosh. And this is the Magruder American Government textbook. It's a brand new version of the textbook. It, I think it's just being launched now. If I recall correctly, it's an eighth grade textbook. And it is the HTML book version of it. So there's a number of things that we've done to try to make this as useful as possible to the audience we intended. First, as you look at the very top, you'll see that it has a Pearson logo, but it does not have a fancy logo of the book. And being a publisher, we tend to put those in all the time. In this case, we felt it really didn't add anything to it, so we made it just a generic logo, not to interfere with anything. And you notice at the top here, there's a button. And by the way, these are all tab accessible. It says skip directly to the table of contents. So by clicking that, you can go, it inserts the concert to the table of contents. So again, these third-party readers will be able to take great advantage of that. There's a second button here that says skip directly to the main content, and that positions the cursor to the beginning of the content. In this case, the cover page is showing, so it'll make more sense when I show other pages. If you go a little further down, you notice the book is created very vertically. And just as a small aside, for those of you who understand K-12, especially K-6 textbooks, that's not normally the case. I think that was brought up by an earlier speaker, in that textbooks, for better or for worse, are becoming much more visually oriented. And they tend to have lots of breakout boxes or text boxes, often displays that cross two pages. So, and this is a point I may want to come back to later in the remarks when we talk about the Kindle. Some of those devices are not especially well suited to take the standard standard textbook and display it electronically. This HTML book has actually done a bit of reflow work and reformatting to make it work as well as possible. So the next line here has a change text size option. And of course, by clicking on the plus, it makes the font larger. By clicking on the minus, it makes the font smaller. And we can show and hide the table of contents. A lot of the Kindle, if I remember correctly, does not have a table of contents. So in a textbook environment, no, a novel, that probably doesn't make the least amount of importance. In a textbook, it's crucial. You notice also at the top here, I can enter a page number, so I can jump directly to page 20 by typing in 20 and pressing go, and I've jumped now in the display to page 20. Again, and not to knock the Kindle, because Pearson supports the Kindle, but just to point out differences, I don't believe that the Kindle has a go-to page, a go-to capability. So if you think of a typical classroom environment where the teacher says, okay, let's all turn our books to page 17, that's something very viable in this model. It may not be viable in other products. And you also have the ability to linearly jump through pages by clicking the right or left arrows. So now I happen to be on page, I think it's 22, and you'll see that the text is there, and it also creates a cookie crumb trail. So if you're referring to the table of contents, I'm in Unit 1, Chapter 1, Section 3, and I can back up by clicking on the table of on the cookie crumb and scrolling up and down. And I'll just flip through a few more pages. And of course, that change text size still works here too. So if you need a larger size text, it works very nicely. Going over to the table of contents for a second, it has the standard expand, collapse metaphor that everyone's familiar with. So I've expanded Unit 1, and then I can expand Skills Handbook and click right on Writing, and now I've jumped into a particular portion of the text. The images are embedded in a linear fashion. So unfortunately, I can't compare and contrast this with the printed book. I should have brought it to show. But it has the same text. It has the same photographs. But the page layout that is on the printed page will be altered to work appropriately within this technology. So this is technology that we have pretty much finished. Tom Starbranch, who sits behind me, is actually one of the key managers for it. And we're going to be making this selectively available for some of our, starting with high school titles, in 2009. and kind of work our way into the market. I guess that reinforces the point I made earlier today about edging our way into the market to understand what the market needs are.
Thank you very much. I have a question for Fritz, and then my panel, I'm sure, has some follow-up questions as well. Fritz, what were the incentives for the motion picture companies to, as I understand it, create these audio versions, alternative audio versions of the movies, voluntarily?
The incentive is that it's the right thing to do. It's certainly not something that is a significant or any revenue source that I'm aware of. My understanding is that the studios over the years have worked with a number of groups that represent the blind. I think WGBH has been involved in audio description, and they do it because it's the right thing to do.
And are they're available in theaters?
Yes.
And is that it, or are they distributed as DVDs?
Some are distributed in DVD, but I'm told that not many movies are available or video described on DVDs for a number of reasons, one of which is simply lack of demand. Also, at one time, shelf space was a factor. I think that's becoming much less so as compression techniques allow more and more material to be put on a DVD. I think that's something that requires more work. Personally, I would like to see more movies available with video description on DVDs.
Thank you. You're looking very thoughtful, Mr. Shapiro.
Nothing in particular on this.
Thanks. Well, I thought maybe a good first question for this panel, since this is the panel on initiatives, would be just to kind of open up the floor to ask what initiatives there are out there, either that you're aware of or that your organizations are a part of, in terms of providing more accessible materials to the blind and other persons with disabilities. And here I think we are talking both about commercial marketplace initiatives and also nonprofit or library-based initiatives. So is there anyone who would like to tell us a little bit about some initiatives?
Carrie?
For the most part, there aren't any initiatives at the higher education level with academic libraries. There aren't any special initiatives in the public libraries. The K-12 school libraries work very closely with the existing agencies, and they manage to get many of their needs met. I think that if you are on a college campus, you'll see that just the way things are divided up, there's adaptive technologies like divisions that serve people that have handicaps, and only tangentially will work with the library. Sometimes the library may have adaptive equipment, but a lot of times they don't. Public libraries, I think they generally believe that they do not have a role in serving the visually impaired unless they have a specific like division. Like there are some really exemplary programs, DC Public, Cleveland Public Library. They have a very, very well thought out plan. They serve many, many people. But many of the libraries that I talk to that are public libraries think that they're not allowed to make certain formats for the blind. They don't think that they're allowed to, and that they have to turn that request over to an authorized agency. So I would say that there's not too much going on in the schools, and I mean in the public libraries and academic libraries.
Ellen, I'd like to ask you, what are the right economic incentives for publishers these days to move to a more market-based approach? What is it that publishers need?
It's a very difficult question to answer, in part because, as I've said before, membership of AAP is a good example of the sectoral nature of publishing. And what might work for trade publishers, for example, whose works were chiefly at issue in the dispute over the Kindle II is not necessarily the same thing that's going to work for educational publishers or professional and scholarly publishers. I think part of the problem here is that there is, unfortunately, no mandate in the marketplace for the kind of shift in media that we saw, for example, with respect to motion pictures or to music, where there was a situation where the DVD came along and completely supplanted VHS tapes, for example, because not only did they provide a sharper, clearer picture, but they had enhanced storage capability, which allowed more material to be put on the product that would be distributed in the marketplace. Similarly with music, we watched as a succession of media not just came along to supplement, but to supplant what came before it. And you don't see people much today using 8-track tapes or cassette tapes. And very shortly, according to my friends in the music industry, the CD is probably going to go the way of its predecessors as people get their music almost exclusively through a downloading model. So for publishers who for 400 years have essentially had a format for the literary work that actually was quite successful, it's durable, it's portable, relatively cheap, they're having to gamble on the extent of their investment in digital formats and whether or not that's going to meet the tastes as well as the needs of consumers in the marketplace for reading materials. As I've said, I think in the last 8 years or so, some of the early hyperbole about what people thought was going to take off with respect to e-books simply didn't come about. And there are a lot of reasons for that. As I said, the e-book isn't a product that is put together simply by a publisher and put out into the marketplace. It's a product that is a combination of hardware and software producers as well as the publisher and ultimately the author's work. And unfortunately, as long as there is still a proprietary dispute and combat in the marketplace for dominance as to which formats are going to continue to predominate, whether we're going to be dealing with a particular type of dedicated reading device, whether the preference is going to be for people to read ebooks on PDAs or their iPhones or on PCs, frankly, from the publisher's perspective, ebooks remains a pretty uncertain proposition in the marketplace. And the kind of investment that we've been talking about to transition one's production facilities away from what was primarily designed to produce a print on paper book, now to produce something in digital form, and what that transition should be, how you set up a production system that's designed to produce works in digital format, still remains a matter of uncertainty to many publishers in different sectors because they simply don't know if the marketplace is ready to accept those versions. So it's really, I'm not trying to be evasive. I can't tell you that there is a list of three or four or five particular things that I think would create incentives for publishers. I know that, again, the existence of a regulatory framework based on a copyright exemption does give them pause about how much they can commit to the idea of universal design products in digital formats as long as there exists legal authority for people to widely reproduce and distribute those copies without permission or payment.
I'd like to get back to Michelle's question. Thank you, Ellen. Dr. Kircher, if you could wait for just 1 minute, you'd like to respond to Ellen, I gather. I'd like
2 points, but yeah.
Okay, if we can come right back to you. I'd like to ask Mr. O'Reilly to tell us what initiatives are underway at the National Library Service. How are you embracing new technology? How have you arrived at that point to make the decisions that you've made, and how are you serving your patrons in new ways?
Right. As I mentioned in the earlier panel, we've just shipped 5,000 proprietary digital talking book machines to 8 test libraries, along with a little starter kit of I think 52 digital books. that will be circulated among a small number of patrons who are known by the libraries to be active readers and interested in their libraries and their reading, committed to it, and we'll be collecting feedback on that prior to the go ahead on true mass production of these machines. And Plextor Limited in Japan is our contractor. In addition, in tandem, we've been building we call it BARD, the Braille and Audio Reading Download. We have, I think, about 15, sorry, the numbers have escaped me. There are several thousand books, digital books, online available to patrons who are heretofore have been using the HumanWare Stream to download these. And I think there are a couple of other commercial machines that Icon, maybe one of you, what's the other one?
Braille Plus.
Sorry, yeah, of course. That can read NLS books. In the very near future, we expect to integrate Web Braille, which is a web-based contracted Braille book system, with the audio books to have a unitary system. Patrons will be able to download Braille books or audio books, or both, and use them with the appropriate equipment. That's okay. Taken up a lot of our energy.
Thank you very much.
May I say one other thing?
Yep.
People have no one has. I'm concerned about this text to speech proposition because I know a lot of our patrons have been unhappy with synthetic speech and want human voice renditions of books. And are, as I said, that might be perfectly fine with an auto repair manual or a law book, say. But but for our recreational reading, Michael Connolly and Danielle Steele and so on, synthetic speech is not altogether happy. And I also wanted to say, I think this is the postmodern era, and we're supposed to be engaged in fluidity and fragmentation, and I think that's probably what we're ultimately looking at. I wouldn't object to the withering away of the National Library Service, provided the people who use it, who are maybe indigent or immobile or remote or reclusive or computerless, are served in some fashion. In the model, the traditional model of a free library service. Thanks.
Thank you. I have Dr. Kircher followed by Mr. Labar, followed by Mr. Thomas.
I tested the Pearson product in development. Good work. Terrific. I believe that was generated from the NIMAS files, the DAISY XML files. I think that's right. A lot of work went into the features and functions and how it worked, but the actual transformation was from XML file set. Am I right?
Yes.
So future products will not require the amount of research and development to make the next book. You've learned a lot, and the process will become more automated. I don't know how much handwork goes into it, but hopefully that can be, a lot of that can be automated. Are you optimistic there?
Yeah, please.
I recall your conversation from this morning about the need to automate processes, and I couldn't agree with you more. The way to drive down costs is to automate processes and reduce this, quote, handwork. And that's what we need to do, is as we retool ourselves, I think as you pointed out, from a print environment to a digital and print environment,
the need to have very efficient processes whereby, for the most part, it generates a file format compatible with this HTML book. It is the issue to us because it right now is an added cost to us, and it is an uncertain market in terms of recovering that cost. So if we were to bear a multi-dollar per page cost with uncertain revenue opportunities, that just is not a viable business model for us.
So in the same way of thinking about the XML transformations that need to take place, I'm told by publishers that are part of the International Digital Publishing Forum that they are exclusively shipping EPUB to their distributors. So the variety of proprietary systems are all getting the same content feed from the publishers in the EPUB format. So there's variety there, and it's you buy one EPUB reader and you can use certain kinds of content, but the feed from the publishers is the same XML source content. So that's very optimistic. But I did want to respond to Alan's concern that if there's a copyright exception, that this accessible HTML version that Pearson will sell would be taken by an authorized entity and distributed freely. I don't think it's ever happened, to my knowledge. And I don't know why that an organization, a trusted intermediary, would do that. I don't understand that argument. It may be a fear, but you know, I don't see that as a something that should keep people awake at night.
Please go ahead.
I mean, George, one of the reasons why it's a matter of concern, frankly, is because I think people are beginning to find out the sophistication of what a digital talking book actually embodies at this point. And we had the problem, for example, with implementation of the NIMIS standard and the NIMIC repository center under the IDEA amendments of 2004, where certain groups wanted to qualify as authorized entities to be able to have access to those files. One thing that was problematic for us was we said, sure, I mean, to the extent we know the major authorized entities, which would be the folks sitting around this table plus Bookshare, that would be something that possibly could work if somebody was willing to take responsibility for any others who wanted to step forward and qualify as third-party authorized entities. And we quickly learned that was beyond the capability of the American Printing House as the host of the NIMAC Center. We learned from the Department of Education's Office of Special Education that they didn't want the responsibility of determining who is or who is not legitimately an authorized entity, nor did anyone want the responsibility of ultimately, once these groups were designated as qualifying to use those files, to monitor their activities, to make sure that ultimately they followed the rules and regulations and the guidelines. So we're hearing that no one wants to take responsibility for a concept that is easily expandable and for which there will be incentives for it to expand, to introduce additional third parties who will say, we would like to serve as an authorized entity under the Chafee Amendment.
So, can I?
Yeah, please.
So, okay, I'm with you. So the idea of a trusted intermediary, that concept is in need of care and feeding, further development, so that publishers will be happy with organizations that are good citizens, that report and do all the things that would be defined within, you know, a trusted environment to facilitate this flow of XML information that can be transformed. That thing then, that level of trust has not been established, and it creates that fear of copies flying everywhere without
concern. Well, again, and it's because it's part of a regulatory approach for which people say there is scant additional appropriations for them to do what is necessary, or they just simply disavow having the jurisdictional responsibility. So, for example, if you want to move forward with a trusted intermediary approach, then building on a question Maria asked in the last panel is, why wouldn't you do that through a licensing relationship between the producer of these materials and the trusted intermediary, rather than the trusted intermediary gaining its authority under a copyright exemption, when the rest of the regulatory framework around it isn't in place to ensure that that person is, in fact, a bona fide authorized entity, and that its conduct, once it has access to these materials, will comport with the regulations?
But they're not mutually exclusive. And you do need to have the trusted relationships with the organizations, and also the many publishers who do not have the will or capabilities to make accessible versions, to play with the trusted intermediaries. You still need that exception available. So,
well, I mean, we're working with them now. In answer to Maria's question before, when she asked about the incentives for a market-based approach to this, that doesn't mean that publishers aren't currently doing a variety of things. As I said, publishing is a sectoral industry where different publishers have different perspectives on this. So just to give you an example of three things, recently some two dozen publishers announced that they have signed agreements with Bookshare to provide, over the next few years, tens of thousands of their books, their backlist books, to Bookshare so that those will be available in accessible forms. That includes publishers like Random House, HarperCollins, Scholastic, Hachette, O'Reilly, Perseus Books, and Townsend Press, but clearly it doesn't include others who, for whatever reason, have decided that they're not interested, at the moment at least, in that kind of a relationship. Similarly, in the wake of the announcement about the Kindle 2, there was recently the introduction of the Kindle DX, as you know, which was touted as being able to hopefully be used not only for newspapers, but also specifically for textbooks. And in that same announcement, you had leading textbook publishers, Cengage Learning, John Wiley & Sons, and Pearson, who together comprise about 60% of the higher education textbook publishing industry, have agreed that they're going to provide their books through the Kindle. But again, the others who comprise that other 40%, apparently for whatever reason, aren't there yet. So there is a diversity here. The marketplace is producing results. It's doing it in different ways, depending upon how these different players who are in competition within their own spheres see it in their best interests to come forward now. And I would suggest to you that, again, the only reason they're not yet seeing it fully in their best interest to come forward with a universally designed product that incorporates accessibility at the get-go and put that out into the marketplace is because they don't have a full understanding of how that is likely to go forward in the face of a continuing regulatory approach based on a copyright exemption.
Thank you. Mr. LaBarre and then Mr. Thomas.
Thank you. Civil rights have never been accomplished or achieved by operation of the market, and never will be. With respect to the comments regarding IDEA, I think that our perspective is it's not been an issue of the trusted intermediaries. It's really been an issue of compliance of the publishers to create the files, and even more of a problem has been the local educational agencies not complying with the law. And that is from our perspective. And then I want to take this time to talk about initiatives of the National Federation of the Blind in this area. And I guess this goes with the theme of removing the epidermis of your favorite or least favorite domesticated animal. In other words, there are many ways to get that accomplished. We come at this from a variety of perspectives. We believe firmly in advancing technology and sort of trying to take away the arguments about whose copyright is it and just get direct access to whatever it is. For example, I speak of the KNFB Reader, which is a handheld cell phone that can snap a picture of a page and read it out loud, and it's virtually instantaneous now, the cost of which keeps coming down. We are, of course, involved in the Reading Rights Coalition, involving the Kindle 2, but that's not just relevant to the Kindle 2. It's relevant to a wide variety of access to literacy, because that's what we're talking about here. It's access not just to the book, but it's access to literacy and what literacy brings. We are involved with the effort of the Louis Braille commemorative coin. Why is that important? That promotes Braille literacy. We know that one of the reasons that people can make the argument, although I don't accept it, but make the argument at least that, you know, Braille's too expensive, etc., is that not enough people read Braille. The more people that read Braille, perhaps the more the cost can come down. And we believe Braille is part of literacy for the blind, and thus the literacy program connected with the sale of the Louis Braille commemorative coin. As most people know, Louis Braille was born 200 years ago, and the striking of this coin celebrates that birth. And finally, I guess I'm just sick and tired of the idea that, you know, all these things that are being done for the blind are special or exemptions or exceptions or whatever. I really like what Dr. Kircher has been talking about in terms of we've got to think about this from a universal design angle. And we just have to do it and make a commitment to it, because publishers the book's got to start somewhere. And these days, the book does start in a technological form. You know, after you get the manuscript from the author, who usually does it now on a computer, but not all of them, of course, but a lot of them do now, and you will see that more and more, there is a digital copy. And the more we think about universal design and the more we just make it happen, the less there will be this argument about cost.
Thank you, Mr. Thomas, and then Mr. Aiken.
Sure, I just wanted to talk briefly about new initiatives underway at RFB&D. Mr. O'Reilly referred to the human audio versus synthetic speech discussion, and RFB&D does continue to be dedicated to human audio. One of the commenters to this request talked a little bit about the importance of understanding tone and inflection in speech, and the different capabilities that human audio provides in that area. We are expanding and changing fundamentally, really, our delivery platforms for that, and I spoke a little bit about this earlier. Mr. Adler referred to the evolution away even from CDs now, and we've seen that within the last year. We've introduced two different downloadable versions of our services, and already within that year, I was told last week, I think that nearly half of the books that are requested from us are already via the downloadable formats. So we're certainly seeing that the downloadable formats offer more flexibility than the CDs. One of the versions of our formats plays on a Windows Media platform, so no specialized playback equipment is required. And then for portability, it's downloadable on any or most commercially available MP3 players. So we're really removing some of the cost barriers and portability challenges. And then the other thing to add is, you know, having made the statement of our dedication to human audio, we certainly recognize
the increasing importance of text-to-speech technology. Clearly, there's a high degree of flexibility with that format, and we're moving into that area as well and expanding our availability of those formats.
Thank you. Paul?
Yeah, I want to bring up one quite large private initiative with respect to accessibility, and that's the settlement of our class action lawsuit against Google that I'm sure you've all heard of. If approved, it will make tens of millions of out-of-print books available, not just to those who can read in traditional manner, but also readers with any sort of print disability. The settlement commits to making the electronic text to be available in conjunction with screen enlargement, voice output, and refreshable braille displays. This is revolutionary. This would bring an enormous volume of works and make them accessible to the blind, the equivalent of several large academic libraries, and shouldn't be ignored in this context.
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Chapman.
Two quick points. One, going back to the NIMAC issue. We intend to sell the HTML book, and of course, we also intend to price it in line with our other ebooks. So we don't intend to significantly discount it nor significantly raise its price. But it makes obvious sense that we can't sell it if there's an alternative distribution, which is for free. And while we are willing to sell it directly or sell it with partners, can't compete when the alternative doesn't cost anything. Second point, I want to jump on the actor recorded audio bandwagon of a minute ago. We have the ability to, in Pearson, use both synthesized and actor recorded audio. And I profess no specialized knowledge here other than to talk with my literature teams constantly. And it is their uniform decision to go with actor recorded audio, especially at the younger grade levels, especially in literacy, for what should be obvious reasons. It just produces a better learning experience. The other thing that struck me, which surprised me, is I would have thought that synthesized audio is much less expensive. It turns out that may not be true. In some circumstances, it probably is. In some circumstances, it isn't, because you have to pre-synthesize the audio. And there, even the state-of-the-art of synthesized audio is not good enough for textbooks in many instances, and it has to be tweaked, and that's handwork. And by the time you've done that, the cost differential between that and hiring an actor and getting a polished recording is less than you would think, less than I thought.
Can I ask one quick question about that point? If you're doing charts and graphs as well, and you're going back and adding human narration of those charts and graphs, does it make more sense to do the human audio on the front end than the synthetic speech, and then go back in and add the human audio descriptions of the charts and graphs, or is that not really a consideration?
Way that I'm in the midst of releasing some audio textbooks in the next couple months. And there is a complicated process, but fundamentally you start from the print-ready PDFs, that which goes to the book, to go to the publisher. And that information is given to a company that we use, and they record the audio. They have a polished actor rehearse the script and read it. That produces an audio MP3 file and an XML file. That XML file is then merged back with the PDF file, and that produces the book in our case. So all that must be done before the book is released. It's a process that happens beforehand. And whether you hire an actor and record that audio, or you feed it into one of these synthesizer devices, which produces a synthesized audio, it doesn't really matter. You have to merge that audio, be it synthetic or actor, with the text, with the PDF, and by this XML. So I don't think it matters, but my point earlier was that it turns out that the synthesized audio is not good enough and typically has to be tweaked, at least in our industry, in our part of the industry.
Mr. Mr. Mudd, and then Dr. Kircher, and then Alan.
Thank you. I'm just wanted to bring us back from where I stand, and that's speaking up for the Braille or tactile learner. I love the digital audio that's out there, whether it's synthesized or human voice. It's another way to access information. But please don't do harm to Braille, because to the tactile learner, and there are many of us out there, Peter, for instance, was that a geography book that you showed?
It was government.
Government, okay. Just to emphasize the tactile, if let's say the state of Texas, if it's just an audio description of the state of Texas, I'm subject to your interpretation of what that state looks like. But if it's a tactile representation, I know what it looks like. So those things need to be kept in mind with all the digital talk, and I love it, I appreciate it, and I think we definitely need to explore that to the full extent. But please don't forget about Braille.
Sure.
So the doctoring of the text files for processing with a TTS engine can be very time-consuming and expensive. That's not taking place on the Kindle 2. They're just doing pretty much a raw dump. And yes, they did go back and fix up Barack Obama's pronunciation, but to do that for many, many, many of the words in there is something that they're not going to do, but that might be done by a publisher who's going to produce a textbook that's using TTS. So that's one of the really good points. There's a couple other initiatives that, just to let you know about, there's a group called CourseSmart.com. It's funded by publishers, I believe, and they have like 6,300 college titles. The problem is that they're all inaccessible. And there was no requirements for accessibility going into that, and it's not a product that a blind person could use or most people with disabilities. So that's real sad. The DAISY Consortium is the maintenance agency for the ANSI ISO standard. That's the official term, ANSI ISO Z3986, and we're undergoing a revision to the standard. And we do want to add video to the standard, and we want to expand the XML that could be used to make it more flexible and easy for publishers to use whatever XML they have in-house and not require them to use just one flavor of XML. And then we're also providing the open source tools for the automatic manipulation. And this year we're coming out with a interactive authoring tool that would help in the audio production. And it's open source, and we'd love the participation of everybody in that. We're severely constrained financially in doing what we can, but trying to focus strategically on the technologies that will give you the biggest bang for your buck.
Thank you for that information. Mr. Adler, and anybody else?
Yeah, I just two comments. One was I didn't want one to leave hanging an impression that some people might have gotten from Scott's comments about publishers not cooperating with NIMAC. In an article published in The Educator earlier this year, by the staff of NIMAC at the American Printing House, there's this quote: "The response from publishers has been greater than we ever expected, with over 70 publishers currently working with us and over 12,000 file sets submitted in just our first 20 months of operation. The reality is not that there isn't enough input of files coming from publishers, it's that they do not have the capability of being able to handle that many files coming in as quickly as they have been coming in, and being able to establish and verify the accounts of the authorized users to come and use those files." And then just in the area of initiatives, I wanted to mention that, again, noting the sectoral nature of the industry and the needs of people in a particular context on the ground, we are in the process of launching the beta version of something called Access Text Network, which is a joint project resulting from an agreement between the Association of American Publishers and the Alternative Media Access Center set up by the Georgia Board of Regents and the University of Georgia. And this is going to greatly expedite the ability of colleges and universities, DSS offices all around the country, to be able to find out where textbooks that are needed in electronic files for use to create alternative formats are available. And in fact, even though we are, as I said, we're only in the process of the beta launch late this spring, already we're finalizing membership agreements with the DSS offices and academic publishers, and the database is importing over 300,000 book titles that are used in academic courses at colleges and universities across the country. So this is an example where, again, perhaps it's not the market-based approach based on universal design, but it's an approach that has been welcomed by the DSS offices on college campuses all across the nation because it suits their immediate needs and it fits with their immediate needs. But again, it plugs into the regulatory approach based on the copyright exemption in doing so.
Dr. Kircher.
So the access text provides a link between the Disabled Student Service Office and the publisher who has some kind of files to give them. And then the DSS office has the responsibility to manufacture the book in an accessible form and turn it over to the student. So they're not getting completed books. They're getting the data for manufacturing of the books.
Right.
We have about 10 minutes. Do any of my colleagues have questions? Steve? Sure.
I'll come back to you, Mr. Adler. You, in your written comments, referred to the relatively positive development of a relationship between publishers and Bookshare. And in particular, you referenced as part of that developing partnership the 7-point digital rights management plan. So I think a lot of what we're talking about today is trying to encourage those sorts of partnerships. So I was wondering if you could spend a few moments telling us what was unique, or if not unique, at least significant in the magic that made that relationship develop as well as it did, and what we can do to foster a repetition of that set of events vis-a-vis publishers and other organizations.
As I've indicated in my statement before by mentioning the trade publishers who are working with Bookshare, there are many members of AAP and many members of the publishing community who think that Bookshare has been organized in a fairly responsible manner as an authorized entity under the Chafee Amendment. And they have worked with Bookshare to develop the processes both for their volunteer agreements involving the scanning of works into digital form, as well as the agreements that they have with their subscriber membership, who for a nominal fee get access on an annual basis to the full library of Bookshare, which is now, I believe, something around 40,000 works and is exponentially increasing annually. But there are some members who are wary of Bookshare despite all of this. Particularly educational publishers are concerned about Bookshare's desire to expand its work beyond U.S. borders. And Bookshare has been commendably cautious about doing that, but nevertheless, it's fairly ambitious to do that.
Can I interrupt you for a second? Let's drill down a little bit.
Right.
What specifically is the concern about expanding beyond U.S. borders, and how is that distinct from a relative lack of concern about within the U.S.?
Well, because we don't know that Bookshare is able to handle the responsibility of dealing with questions that arise about how those materials are used once they are, in fact, transmitted outside the United States, and whether or not it feels that it has a responsibility, indeed, to monitor the use of those materials pursuant to these agreements, and even if they do, whether they actually can enforce their agreements in other countries, where the infrastructure may be different, where the basic laws, both of copyright and with respect to contract, may be very different than those in the United States. But the reason we've had a fairly good relationship with Bookshare, despite all of the bumps, is that right from the outset, they indicated that they understood the concerns of the publishers about both making sure that their works were not subject to widespread unauthorized reproduction and distribution so that they would compete with them. And they also understood, very importantly, that book publishers often don't have the full rights to be able to make works available in digital formats. One of the issues that came up with the IDEA legislation, for example, was the fact that we needed a separate amendment to the Chafee Amendment in order to protect publishers from copyright infringement liability if, in fact, they provided the electronic files in the NIMUS format that were required by that legislation. So we don't have that kind of protection at the moment, the publishing community, for providing these materials in digital format for anything other than the IDEA purposes. But nevertheless, there is a risk. The people at Bookshare understood that, and they recognized that for certain kinds of works, where perhaps the publisher didn't have digital rights to the images or illustrations or other portions of the work apart from the literary work itself, that those works could not be put into the system under the same terms as would other works to which the publishers had the full rights to exploit.
Okay. Well, we're getting very close to the 1 o'clock, and I wanted to give Michelle the floor one last time before we close for lunch.
Thanks.
Wrap it up.
I'd like to circle back to DRM we were talking about in the prior panel, and Dr. Kircher, in particular, some of the comments you made in your written submission about concerns with prevention of legitimate use of materials by the target disabled population. You then gave some suggestions about guidelines being established to encourage education on proper use of materials, administrative steps to prevent abuse, passwords for downloads, and fingerprinting and watermarking of files to control the use of content by the target disabled population. And suggested that those might be, I believe, if I'm reading this correctly, an alternative to the use of DRM and strong encryption. And I wondered if you could elaborate a little more on your thoughts about what these alternatives might be and how they might improve accessibility.
What I outlined is what Jim Fruchterman and Bookshare are using in their seven-point plan. And the DAISY Consortium came out with a position statement about this, favoring this kind of approach over actual hardcore encryption. Right now, Recording for the Blind and Dyslexic uses hardcore encryption, so does the Library of Congress. So I've got books that I can't use on any other device except a particular device that I might use. So it's absolutely legitimate use. It's my player, but I have to use a particular player to use it, and I can't move it in between different reading systems. So I've got for example, DAISY reading systems on cell phones now. And it'd be very convenient to take that content and move it over to my cell phone and play it. But that cell phone device does not support the encryption. So the watermarking and fingerprinting of content provides a mechanism to track materials if we find that it's abused. But to wholesale encrypt everything, it prevents legitimate use. I think, especially in the schools, it could be very torturous for teachers to have one player, one book associated with it, as opposed to having something that was more flexibly used with a variety of different hardware and software devices.
Well, thank you very much. I think with that, we're going to end the morning. It's been extremely comprehensive and very helpful to the government panel. I know, Paul, you need to go back to New York promptly. Thank you for the Authors Guild for coming. And for everybody else, I hope you will join us promptly at 2:30 for possible actions to facilitate and enhance access.